the McDouble is here to add some sizzle to your day. And now you can enjoy it with McDonald's 4 for 4 deal. Choose between a cheesy McDouble or a delightfully crispy McChicken. Then add 4-piece chicken McNuggets, a small order of crispy fries, and a refreshing medium-sized soft drink like an ice-cold Coke for just $4. Now that's a tasty deal. Swing by and add some sizzle to your day with McDonald's 4 for 4. Price and participation may vary, cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. The McDouble is here to add some sizzle to your day. And now you can enjoy it with McDonald's 4 for 4 deal. Choose between a cheesy McDouble or a delightfully crispy McChicken. Then add 4-piece chicken McNuggets, a small order of crispy fries, and a refreshing medium-sized soft drink like an ice-cold Coke for just $4. Now that's a tasty deal. Swing by and add some sizzle to your day with McDonald's 4 for 4. Price and participation may vary, cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal.
Goombas out there, and welcome to the Paranormal Mafia Sicilian Hour with me, Dr. John Giovanni, the boss, the capo of the South Bronx, and my wonderful and charming host, co-host, Seraphine Hurley. Hello there, Seraphine, and we're going to make everyone an offer they can't refuse tonight.
Absolutely.
How are you feeling? You doing all right?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing good. I'm doing good. I'm trying to vary our introduction a little bit and see what else that I have. I got to say hi to Uncle Vito, acting godfather, and my bodyguards, Jimmy the Bones Bondi and Julio the Enforcer Cruz, and Vinny Goomba from Brooklyn. Hi, Vinny. Oh, my cousin Marcia, the family counselor. So I got to get them all in there. So hello, family. Salute. Okay. Anyway, back to my normal. Got to get my normal glasses so I can see to do the show. How's that?
And I'm just left holding the cannoli.
Anyway, well, thank you, Seraphine. And by the way, thank you for all the one. I mean, you're just amazing with the graphics you do to
promote our show. You're welcome.
I mean, everyone's been complimenting on it. You do the pyramids for the. If any of you out there haven't seen on YouTube what Seraphine does, it's amazing. She's got an ad for this show with pyramids spinning around and all music and all kinds of stuff. And it's just, I don't know how she does it, but thank you very much. And I think it makes a big difference. So, and I forgot what the hell we're going to talk about tonight. What are we doing tonight?
Well, I thought we were going to talk about pyramid research, but well, you know, you can talk about anything you want.
How about my Sicilian olive oil business? Not doing too good.
Do you have a bridge to sell me?
No, I rented it. Think I was stupid? Yeah, Vinny Goomba from Brooklyn said, I say the Brooklyn Bridge. I said, I already bought the Tappan Zee Bridge from you, but I'll rent the Brooklyn Bridge. Thought I was stupid. Oh.
Nice.
And remember, you are never alone. There's always some agency listening in.
Yes, this is true.
I got nervous. Facebook said I had all these people following me, and I kept looking behind me. So I don't know. I'm getting a little paranoid. So.
Well, I mean, people say that they're following me or watching me. I always put on a good show.
Yeah, what the heck?
Might as well make it worth it.
They want to watch you. They're going to watch you. They're going to listen to you. They're going to listen to you.
Exactly.
So, you know, keep it dirty so you can entertain them, you know?
Maybe exactly.
I can swear in 8 languages. Yeah, it's true. When I was in graduate school, I lived in a graduate dorm with 95% foreign students. And the first thing was I asked them to teach me how to swear in their language. Italian, I didn't need any help, but everything else I did. So anyway, I was watching, I think I mentioned it to you. I found somebody else I knew. I was watching the Irishman, which is really, oh my God, that's really a great movie. And I knew there's actually 3 people. Now it's 4 in the movie that I either met in person, had a meeting with, did something for, or, you know, whatever. And Fat Tony was in there. Could they mention him? I don't think they showed him. Fat Tony and Vinny the Chin Gigante. My mother-in-law knew his brother, Father Lou Gigante, in the South Bronx. He had a church. Vinny the Chin was the capo of the Genovese family. And he had another brother, Mario, who was also. So maybe this show should be Paramafia Instructions 101. But anyway.
Yeah, but rule number one should be don't incriminate yourself.
That's right. I've already been incriminated. My age? No. And I'm making this up. I actually did have a meeting with one of Jimmy Hoffa's lawyer in an elevator in a Teamsters building. I was a young person at that time. I told you that last week, I think. But anyway, yeah, I watched it again and I missed it. They mentioned Fat Tony. Hey, Vinny, they mentioned their buddy Fat Tony. Okay. So, see, people are tuning in thinking I'm going to talk about the pyramids and I'm talking about this garbage. Okay. Well, actually, sanitation and construction are the big things in New York that they run. Well, I shouldn't say that. Better watch what's going on here. Okay. So, what do you have to say? I already made an ass of myself. Go ahead. Your turn.
Nice hat.
Covers my bald spot. What the hell?
So, are we going to talk about pyramids?
Yeah. Oh, before we do that, maybe we'll talk about pyramids the last 10 minutes. You won't believe this. Because we talk a lot, I've been clearing out in the basements and storage areas of my house. And I came upon something that I didn't know I had anymore. And it's probably about 40 years old. And I don't know if I can show this or not, but let's see. Ooh, can you see that? That is...
Well, if you quit wiggling it.
Okay. It's the section of a hand of a cadaver.
Oh, that's cool.
And when I was teaching human gross anatomy at the University of Illinois, and I wrote my first book ever. Here's another one. This is the Palmer view of the right hand. Kind of cool, isn't it?
That's really neat.
For those of you who are just listening, these are large pictures of the sections of hand. And I have one of a foot. And in color. And I had some students who were artists. And I was in the process of writing an anatomy book with the head of the anatomy department at the University of Illinois, where I taught human gross anatomy. I was the best dissector, by the way.
And of course you were.
I'm the best at everything right now. So we decided to write a book together. And I can't write and color like do any kind of diagrams. I'm the worst artist in the world. And so we got some students who were willing to do stuff for, and I actually found a copy of it. Look at that. Human Anatomy, a Study Guide by Stanley G. Stolpe. He was the head of the anatomy department, and John A. DeSalvo. And that was actually the largest undergraduate human anatomy department in the country that we taught. There's like 500 students per semester. And we used actual cadavers. They were actually dissected already, but the students got to use it. So
not pretend ones?
Which ones?
Not pretend ones?
No, real ones. No. every time they got a fresh cadaver in, they called me because they knew I really was the best dissector. So we would like...
Johnny the Butcher.
Yeah, I would dissect it. So, by the, you know, there was like, we had like a bucket of arms, a bucket of legs, a bucket of hands. So, like, let's say I was going to teach the, no, I was going to teach the anatomy of the hands. I come into class, I say, get your partner, go to the bucket and get a hand. So they go in and walk. And then they would use our book here to, you know, learn whether it was the nerves, the muscles, or whatever.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Did you ever just have right hands or left hands, or does it matter when you're doing a dissection in a study?
You know, there's variations, obviously, between the left and the right. And we would,
I know that, but does it really matter?
Yeah, it's good because the students can see that it's not like always textbook. Cool. So we did have both. The funniest story was my late wife was going to meet me in the my lab, which was across from the anatomy lab. That's where I did my research. And so she was going to come up to have lunch with me. And she walks into my office and looks like she just saw a ghost. And I said, Val, what happened? And she said, I just saw a guy walking through the hall with a head in his hand. I said, I was one of my students. We're doing the head anatomy and muscles of the face today, you know. True story. It's like funny. So, but you know what? These students really learned the anatomy, because look at it this way. When you like in medical school, like when I was at Hopkins, when you dissect a cadaver, usually there's four on a cadaver, you're only seeing one sample. It goes with your left and right questions.
Right.
When we taught our class, you got a bucket of heads. You saw four or five or six different, and you didn't wait. You didn't waste time dissecting the cadaver because it was already dissected. So you could just learn everything. So our students are really sharp on that. So, and I used to give tours to the morgue. They liked when they had, big shots, they always asked me to give a tour, and I enjoyed it. And I used to be up there at night dissecting by myself, you know. So I did a lot of interesting things in my life. That was one of them. But I have 12 books, 11 books, and this was my first book by, I think it was a William C. Brown Academic Publishers, AV Publishing Group, which is a subsidiary of them. And then I think Penguin picked it up. But it's out of print. I don't know. What year is this thing? I'm giving my age away. Jesus.
A song by Billy Idol, Dissecting by Myself.
Yeah, 1979. I shouldn't say that. So anyway, so I don't know. I just thought that was fun. I couldn't believe finding these. I didn't even know these things existed, you know, which is interesting. So I hope I didn't take too much time away from the pyramids to talk about my past history. Not much this makes me squeamish, you know, except movies. Except movies on exorcisms, but I've studied exorcisms for a couple of years, so that doesn't bother me too much. So I don't like bugs. Cockroaches,
people being gross in general. You don't really stand for people just being disgusting.
Oh God, the worst is pineapple on pizza. Those people should be shot, I'll tell you. Or granola without chocolate in it, you know? I mean, actually, I don't like chocolate granola that much. I just like, you know, a Sicilian pizza. All right, so let's move from our favorite food to the Great Pyramid of Giza and pyramid research. Or do you have anything else you want to talk about?
No, I was hoping that we'd move on to the pyramids, but I'm all about whatever you want, where you want to go, so let's go.
Yeah, I'm just having fun. I don't care.
What's your favorite? Do you have a favorite cadaver?
Yeah, Frankenstein.
Like a favorite cadaver, like a story from a favorite cadaver or anything like that?
Yeah, actually, I do. By the way, I got to give a plug for one of my college buddies, Frank Dell'Ostrito, who was actually my best friend in college for 4 years when we were at Stevens Institute of Technology. And he is one of the world's experts on cult history of Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff. And he writes the best books on it, and it's a cult fiction. And Bob Breyer, the pyramid expert, as many of you know, who the famous Egyptologist, had a section in one of his books on Egyptian magic that Frank wrote. And I didn't see Frank since we graduated, and Bob put us back together again as friends, and we became friends again after like 40 years.
Yeah, so, that's
but
cool.
my favorite dissecting joke was my wife would say, my husband would come home from the lab after dissecting. And he'd strip naked, get in a shower, wash for a half an hour, 40 minutes, and came out and still smelled of formaldehyde.
Formaldehyde's hard to get rid of.
Really was. And the other, you know, what were you going to do? But luckily, you know, I wasn't on the dating scene then. I don't think I would have done so good. Hey, who's your date? Some cadaver? Jesus. they said that even when I didn't have the formaldehyde smell, so I guess it doesn't matter. I shouldn't say that, but anyway. Okay.
Gothic cologne.
Okay, so my favorite cadaver story was, I think, I used to go at night to dissect. One was because it was quiet, and, you know, it was nice. Nobody was in the lab. The whole floor was pretty empty. And so I would really concentrate because, you know, you didn't want to cut nerves and blood vessels because you wanted those, make sure the students saw that. So right. I used to dissect, and somebody happened to come into the lab, and I was like totally oblivious, like I am now most of my life, of things that go on. And he must have been a student, I don't remember, kind of walked by my dissecting table and kicked the switch that raised the table. Okay.
Oh, God.
By accident. And all of a sudden, this cadaver starts coming up at me. And I'm going, seriously, whoa. You know, and I was actually more concerned that I would almost cut myself with the scalpel because of the movement. And but that was a true story. It was really funny. So I tried to be a little more aware when I was dissecting, but you know, who was around me. So well, and then the anatomy, I taught anatomy to the funeral director students. Mm-hmm. And they were the wildest group I've ever taught in my life. You know, and that makes sense because you're dealing with grief all the time and learning that. And I got invited to all their parties. They kind of liked me for some reason. I have a skull they gave me when my last day of teaching them that they all signed and glazed. And I put it out on Halloween. But before I left that college to come out to Northwestern to teach, they threw a party for me, and unfortunately, all the rooms, and I'm not making this up, all the rooms at the college were taken. So we ordered pizza, and so the only place that wasn't occupied was the morgue.
Nice.
So we had the pizza delivered to the morgue, and I won't tell you what we drank the drinks out of, what kind of cups we had. But anyway, the nurses brought that. But anyway, so that was the my last party there. But they were great. They were older students, and they were like, so one of them actually was an artist and actually did most of the drawings that I showed you, and just a fun group of people. But you know, again, it makes sense because when you're dealing with something like that on a daily basis, or even like a student learning it and doing an internship, it must be tough. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know if I could do that. You know, we have enough trouble dealing with our own grief, but dealing with, you know, one person after another, and you want it to be real, not fake, you know. So anyway, so those are my best stories. I probably got some more, which I don't want to tell because, you know.
They'd be too incriminating.
Yeah, well, those are probably the best ones. So.
Nice.
See, I like chatting with you more than talking about a subject because we have fun. We'll get to the pyramids, by the way, out there. Don't worry. You know, we can always continue them next time, too. You know, go ahead.
I was going to say, why get a piece of you when you can get a piece of everybody else?
Yeah.
Dissection. You can have multiple pieces in one day.
God. You know, you just got a wise-ass comment to come back to me as, you know?
Yes, I do.
Very, very impressed.
I got to keep up.
Keeps you on your toes, you know?
Keeps you on your toes.
Yeah, you're also educating me of all the new slang and words, which I didn't know. And sometimes it's embarrassing because I'll use a word that, you know, goes back 20 years and now it means something completely different. And I'm thinking, Jesus, you know, people look at me. What? What did he say? You know, so anyway. Anything else you want to humiliate me with, or is that enough?
Oh, I can humiliate you? Oh, hey. We're opening the table? No? Okay. Oh, okay, fine.
Well, what else? Let me see.
You were kidding.
What other things? I was trying to play around with some divination stuff this week, like tarot cards and some of the stuff I have, and reading some new books and magic stuff. And, you know, I started to realize that I got so many areas of interest, and I'm worrying about if I was going to write another book or not and what it would be on. And I'm thinking, I really got to rethink this. There's so many things that I haven't been able to teach and talk about and research and put out there that maybe there's something important that I need to get out to the world to help people. You know, my goal is to help people spiritually and to make them laugh. I'm not sure which is number one or two, but it's a combination. And maybe that's why I like teaching, because I like to entertain and I like to teach. But but there's so many things, because science now is coming in and validating a lot of the paranormal and psychic stuff. And being a biophysicist and a neurophysiologist, that excites me. Mm-hmm. That there may be actually, in my whole theory of magic, which I believe I'm the first to propose, in my last trilogy on Enochian magic was that the brain, the cortical areas, have about 30, I figured about 30 different areas that code for different experiences in the psychic realm. I call them realms or heavens. And, but I, you know, since I'm not at a university now, I don't have the equipment to test it. But my goal is to really unify science and the paranormal to show that there is a scientific basis for a lot of it. Now, you granted 90% may be BS and, you know, speculation, but, you know, you got to be in the middle. I always say, and you probably agree with me, great discoveries are made by speculation, you know?
Yeah.
And, but maybe 99% of speculations are worthless, but it's that 1% that turns out to be something. And I said this 100 times, Einstein called his daydreaming thought experiments, and he used to daydream what it was like to ride on a light beam. And that's how he developed his general theory of relativity. And so, you know, we can't rule that out. If there was no speculation, we would not have any creativity. But the problem is, make sure you know it's speculation until you have, you know, you have facts. And that's hard today because you got two extremes. You got the academics who think we're a bunch of idiots, and you got the people on the other side who believe in everything they hear. And and so you got to use a little common sense. And, you know, I don't know if common sense is so common anymore, but, you know, anything else you want to add? Let's say this is fun. I like this better than the pyramids. What time is it? All right, we got plenty of time. If not, tune in next week. Do part two of the pyramids. Go ahead. What are you going to say?
No, it's like I was talking about in my show earlier, is that how do we know that we know certain things when there's a lot of speculation and there's a lot of scientific explanation that goes into where our temporal lobes and certain parts of our brain actually do the reminiscing part for our, you know, basically our active imagination, and turns it into a projection into reality. So how do we know what's real and what's not?
Well, you hit it right on the nose. And don't forget, my specialty really is neurophysiology. That was really my PhD research. And you're exactly right. And that's what's so exciting now, because we have all these devices, you know, measuring brain activity. We can stimulate the brain. And I think that's going to be the frontier of this whole area of science and the paranormal. And it's not going to be anymore just, I think I can pick this up or whatever. And let's face it, a lot of the stuff that we think is miraculous or paranormal is going to turn out to be normal physiological and physics events that we can measure. But I still believe there's that 5% or 1% that is a real mystical, supernatural experience. And maybe we'll never be able to explain it. And that's the miracles. No, I agree with you. And maybe that's the miracles. And we all had, I had experiences of a statue coming alive. I told you that in my audience when I was a kid. Things that happened that people could say, maybe a brain anomaly or this or that. But you know what? In our heart, some of us know when something is really real. And we don't need the proof. And sometimes I go one extreme or the other. But I usually kind of, you know, come back in the middle and realize that, because I put my science hat on and I'm thinking, you know, did I really experience this? Is this stuff all going to be explained away? Maybe it is all nothing, you know, we're just a physical entity. And then I go to the other side thinking, now, wait a minute, I had these mystical experiences and they were real. I don't think they were, you know, a brain anomaly or a psychic imagination or wishful thinking. And then you look at like apparitions of Mary and miracles and Fatima and I mean, all religion, and beliefs, just things that look at what the gurus in India do and things. Some of that, I think, you know, will be explained scientifically, and some of it may not be. And so I think this is a very exciting time for science, you know, don't you?
It definitely is in a lot of different ways. I mean, people coming up with different ways of mapping the brain out and telling us exactly what they believe certain things to do. But even then, it is a hypothesis of certain things. But then again, we do have certain tools that definitely do tell us what certain parts of the brain do.
But exactly.
You know, but there's only, what is it, like 30 some odd percent now, 30 to 45% that we're pretty sure of?
Well, let me get rid of a couple wives' tale here. First of all, there's no such thing as left and right brain. I've been saying this for 5 years and nobody believes me. But if you go to the neurophysiological literature, not the, you know, the new age stuff on Facebook, but you go to brain research and the real literature, this whole thing of being having a left brain and a right brain is fallacy. It's not true. The second thing is we have no idea the percentage of brain we use. Some people used to say we only use 10% or 1%. So that's the second fallacy. We have no idea, nothing at all. But that's hard scientific facts. God, I argued with people on Facebook that there's no left and right brain for the last 5 years. I posted research articles and people still don't believe me. So I got to the point is I don't care. Because my left brain is telling me my right brain to leave it alone. Good one, huh?
No, what I meant by what I said was, what percentage do we actually know? We know what parts of our brain actually work, like the different lobes and sections.
Oh, I see.
Go to what?
Well,
what,
yeah.
What exactly moves what, and what? Is this moving information, or is this moving something else? Is this is this part of my brain do this, or this part of my brain wiggling my little finger, or making my little finger dream, or you know,
I
meant by that.
We know a lot of that because we, in fact, that was some of my research at when I was at Hopkins, was the somatosensory system, which is like touch and feeling, and which part of the brains innervate that, and also pain receptors. Like we know the temporal lobe is for hearing, the occipital lobe is for vision, you know, those kind of things. But what percentage it's used, we don't know. And we do know a lot of specific pathways and which is important for medical research and medical cures. But you know, it seems like it seems like we came a long way, but I still think we're really in our infancy when it comes to the brain. I used to teach biofeedback and I used to monitor my own brain waves and GSR and everything. And it's really fun stuff because, you know, you can actually, like I was able to synchronize my different lobes in my brains with alpha rhythm, and that normally can't be done. It only can be done with certain types of medication. Meditation.
Well, that too.
Yeah. Hey. Hey, time for my pills. Okay. I mean, that's really interesting. And that's why sometimes they call meditation a fourth state of consciousness. I did some interesting research into that too. When I took TM back in the 70s and learned other meditations. And it turns out when people kind of say, oh, just sit back and relax and think about it. Yeah, all that'll work. But you know what? There's certain mantras that do have a neurophysiological effect that work much better, 10 times more powerful than just using OM or And I've tested that with physiological monitoring devices that I could change my blood flow to my skeletal muscles, but I only could do it with certain secret mantras. And I give them away. So, you know, I'm a teacher. I just give everything away. I know I don't charge anything. I don't, you know, don't make people an offer they can't refuse. I really think part of my work is to share and give freely. Yeah, I always say freely I was given and freely I will give, except my granola. You have to get your own. I want my own granola. You could have the damn pineapple pizza. I don't give a shit about that. But I want the Sicilian pizza and I want the cannoli. Everything else, take this American foods. I made spaghetti last night without microwaving it for the first time. It's pretty good.
Yeah, I'm pretty proud of you. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So
you should be proud of yourself. That's awesome.
Well, the only mistake I made, I didn't realize you need to cook the noodles before you put the sauce in. But that's okay. It's a little crunchy.
A little crunchy.
Yeah.
Give me some texture.
So pyramids. Let's talk a little bit about pyramids. So I wasted a good half the show, but I had fun. So I don't give a damn. This is fun. Well, I hope the people are entertained and thinking, what the hell's the matter with that guy? You know? Okay. So, see, I always say you got to have a sense of humor to do the work we're doing. Don't you think, Seraphine?
That's pretty true.
You know, you're a researcher, too. And people may not know yes. that if they listen to your other shows, which are excellent.
Thank you.
I was going to say something, too. Why I like your shows and I like ours is that besides this last half an hour, that was different. We always.
We like to mess around.
Yeah, we always. 90% of the time, we bring things of substance, of education.
Yes.
We don't just sit and say, oh, man, yeah, I'm on the fifth dimensional plane in the energy fields and I'm going to heal. You know, that. I mean, give me a break, okay? I want to see the facts before people claim all the stuff. And the people are talking about frequency and vibration. They don't even know the basic mathematical laws of it, or electromagnetic spectrum. And they're talking and they use quantum. And they never took a class in quantum physics or entropy or thermodynamics.
Probably can't spell it.
Exactly. Well, I can't spell, so we'll skip that. I still don't do there and there right.
But
that's not. I mean, people can talk in general terms, but the point is, it's all BS. If it was something specific, I would be interested. But like I said, matter. It doesn't matter. Because matter is energy, and energy is vibration, right?
Mm-hmm.
And music is vibration. So party on, dude.
Party on, Garth.
Got it. So, pyramids. This is the first book ever published on the Great Pyramids and the Giza Plateau from 1646.
I was going to say, and you did not write that book. That look.
I just look old enough that I did.
You're my favorite relic, Doc.
Yeah, I did find the fountain of youth.
It was priceless just for the look, guys.
That was great.
I'm gonna have an asthma attack. Right. That was funny.
Let me show the goddamn book, please. Okay.
No.
Right. Here we go. Wait, now where's the damn camera? I never do this right. Is it coming out upside down or just on my screen?
It's fine.
Okay.
Just don't wiggle.
Pyramid. Oh, I like the wiggle. Feels good. This is pyramid. This is bad. That's Pyramidography, it's called, by Pyramids in Egypt by John Greaves, 1646. This is the first, and actually there were like maybe some articles written, but it's in English. And it's really fascinating because it goes through, see if I can find the picture in here, the inside of the first and fairest pyramid. And that's how kind of obsessed I was with pyramid research, is that when I got into it, I thought I got to have the first book ever. Can you see that okay now? Kind of cool, you know?
Yeah,
and,
doing good.
It's renowned, of course, you know, in a modern thing. And so I searched all over the United States and found an archaeologist who didn't need it, and I bought it. And my first book on the pyramids, do I have it here, was this one. I self-published, forward by Dr. Patrick Flanagan and afterward by Paul Horn. Paul Horn, some people were texting me about sound in the pyramids. Paul Horn was a famous jazz flutist. He probably recorded 40 or 50 jazz albums. Most anybody in jazz would know who he was. And he recorded inside the Great Pyramid, and he recorded playing his flute. And he used to be on my early shows quite a bit. And he actually also was an expert, a teacher of transcendental meditation. But this was actually, besides the anatomy book, this was my, I would say, my first metaphysical book that I published. And it had, it's a pretty big book, like 500 pages, and it had research from almost everything out there. And then this is my Barnes & Noble's book, which was printed several years ago, but it's out of print. So I'm not trying to sell my books because they're out of print. And if you buy them used, I don't get anything. But this was really a magnificent book, and it was featured on the Father's Day table of, you know, all the stores across the country. And they did it in four or five foreign languages too. Oh, that's kind of cool, looking at your book in Dutch and Spanish and French. And I don't speak any language but English, and I can swear in Italian. So it's kind of cool to see that. And so that's something I always tell people. If you're going to, you self-publishing a book is not worthless. I self-published that book, and it took me 5 years to get a publisher, which is Barnes & Nobles, to do it. Maybe if I didn't have it, a self-published book, I wouldn't have gotten a Barnes & Nobles book. So, you know, do what you can. Write if you want to. Publish a book. Have it, you know, put it on Amazon, and maybe somebody will pick it up and whatever. But the interesting thing about the Great Pyramid is that, maybe I'll just, without giving numbers, because who cares, the people always want to know who built it, right? When, and mm-hmm. What's its purpose? Most importantly, what's its purpose? So we'll go over some general things before we, you know, talk about how tall it is and was there a capstone and the interior, what, you know. But a lot of the, you know, academic people say it was built as a tomb for a pharaoh, even though nobody was ever found, no evidence of a burial. Also, the internal chambers, you know, all the pathways. Oh, and the king, and the it's just magnificent. Why would they spend all this time as a burial chamber? It had to be something more important, the Great Pyramid. Now, the other interesting thing is, when was it built?
Uh-huh.
All the other pyramids in Egypt, they put the fourth pyramid in the fourth dynasty of Khufu, but the Great Pyramid is like the jewel, the magnificent building, and all the other pyramids are inferior of it. So it's, the theory is, which I subscribe to, again, it's speculation, we don't have a date on the pyramid, but I think the pyramid was built before the Egyptian culture was ever founded. Now, don't ask me by who, because I don't know. I don't think it was aliens, okay? I'll say that. But I'm not going to rule that out. But I think it was some kind of advanced culture with advanced technology. It could be 20,000 years old, so nothing remains. What's going to remain that long? Nothing. Even metal will disintegrate. So unless we find something in the pyramid or in papyrus, we may not know. So I think when the culture of the Egyptians were formed, they saw this big pyramid, and they tried to copy it. And that's why all the other pyramids are inferior, you know, copies of it. And so then the academics don't want to admit, especially people from Egypt, that it could have been built by a different culture or aliens or whoever, because mm-hmm. it's their culture, their country. They want credit for it. So they shove it in that, you know, fourth dynasty. And that's my theory. That's a lot of people's theories. And then the Sphinx, Dr. Robert Schock and John Anthony West, who are both board members on my Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association, which I founded about 20, 30 years ago. It's GizaPyramid.com. If you listen, the audience wants to go there. It has tons of articles and research papers. It's not really up to date, I got to admit. I got to get that thing updated. But it's Giza Pyramid, GizaPyramid.com. And so that's the theory of, like, who built it. We just don't know, or when. But my speculation, I notice I'm saying speculation. So they get mad at the New Age people. If you have a theory and you don't have facts that are concrete, it's pure conjecture, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I know you agree with that 100%. We've had 100 conversations on that. So my speculation is it's very old, ancient, maybe way before the Egyptian dynasties. It wasn't a burial, you know, monument. There's hundreds of theories of the purpose of it. So we'll go to that now. We don't know the age. We mm-hmm. don't know when it was built. And we don't know who built it. There's really no markings on it. There's some markings found in the relieving chambers that's above the king's chamber. And there's a question that Colonel Weiss found in the 1800s. And there's questions whether he painted those or where they came from, were they mm-hmm. quarries. I just, so much of this that is, you know, we really don't know for sure. But it would be nice to find, wouldn't it be interesting to find some papyrus in one of these secret chambers or something? Mm-hmm. So, purposes, you probably heard of a lot of them, right?
Yes, unfortunately.
Does anyone sound good to you of all the ones you heard?
There's a few, but I'm going to let you take the lead on this since you are the chair.
Well, that's fine. Because I don't think any of them are really have substance except one, which was proposed by Joe Parr. That was my partner in research. He was like the modern day Tesla guy. There was everything from it was used as a grain storage place, which is ridiculous. When you look,
I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah, you look at the interior chambers, and you know, I'm not showing that because a lot of people are listening to us and they can't see it. But just like these beautiful pathways and chambers, the King's Chambers has 100 blocks of granite. The cement is so fine, you can't even separate two blocks. You can't even put laser fine. You can't even put a piece of paper between those. I mean, when you go through it, it's like, man, whoever did it, we can't reproduce it even today with all our technology, you know? So it had to be for something very special. Now, I tend to lean towards a ritualistic or paranormal use, like maybe able to travel. Maybe they fixed it so certain resonances and energies could focus, like in the King's Chamber, and maybe in that coffin that's there, which is empty. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the coffin wouldn't fit through the door to get it in, so the coffin had to be in there before they finished it, unless they levitated it or moved it through hyperspace through the walls. So that's an interesting thing.
Yeah, or folded
too.
Space. Yes.
Yeah. So the question is though, what's the purpose of it? And Joe Parr, and we researched together for 20 years. He passed away several years ago. He, he discovered the gamma ray transducer. He was actually involved in 8 government top secret projects. That's how good he was. Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the government knew the guy was brilliant. And, right. He invented the gamma ray transducer, which is a way of measuring radioactivity in alternative sources. He figured out how to measure ley lines, which I talked about once. I'll do that next week, maybe keep people hanging on, but which is really, was a wonderful, incredible kind of discovery. And, my buddy JJ Hertek's calling me, so I'll call him back after the show. we're going to get him back. We had that show with him and his Dr. Hertek and his wife Desiree. He just didn't come out, but we'll try to get him back on the show. He just sent me his book too. On let me see, maybe I can pull it here. I thought this was really an excellent one of the. I'm really impressed with this. It's called the Giza's Industrial Complex, where I won't go into it now, but I'll let him come back and talk about it. But of all the theories that involve advanced technology, you know, and energy and the use of it, this by far is amazing, really amazing. And we've been colleagues and working together for like 20 years, and he wrote beautiful, inscription for me. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to talk about that because I think it's one of the best theories so far. But Joe Parr felt it could have been used for traveling through time or hyperspace. And in his experiments in his lab, he was able to recreate an energy field around model pyramids. And I'm looking at the time. Maybe we'll talk about that next week. Maybe we'll do that. Let's continue that next week. But the thing is, though, the pyramid to me, because of how it's built, the precision, how it's so unusual, the sounds that are produced in there. He actually has a picture in the Grand Gallery. He produced some sounds and got flashes of light.
Mm-hmm. I've seen those pictures.
Yeah, I mean, and so there's something going on. Joe Parr discovered that if you hit it with a sound frequency of 52 cycles per second, it'll form an energy field, and that's the slope of the Great Pyramid. Now, is that a coincidence? I don't know. Joe spent two nights on top of the Great Pyramid, by the way. I think he's the only person that did that. You know, you weren't allowed to, but, you know, he paid the guard, climbed up, and it was on two separate occasions, one in, I think, 77 and one in 78. And he also knows if there was a capstone or not, and I'll leave that for next time. But what his great discovery was that he could resynthesize or produce that energy bubble around a pyramid, and it blocks off all radiation, all known radiation. And it only happens and closes off completely when the Great Pyramid is aligned with the sun's neutrino belt and the constellation Orion. Now, that's interesting.
That's really cool.
Is there a conduit that some space travelers may have made? I don't like to use the word aliens, or dimensions that the pyramid was a way to travel between?
Stargate.
You know, you got it. You got it. Again. No, we do have one piece of evidence. Unfortunately, we don't have pictures of it. And I'm going through a lot of his stuff. But one thing was that when the pyramid was on, we had to use a centrifuge to spin the pyramid with an alternating electric magnetic current. And that produced an energy field around the pyramid. But around in December, when the Earth was lined up with the sun and there's a neutrino belt that is intensified at that time. And if you go past the sun, that points directly to Orion. The pyramid energy field surrounding it, we called it an orb or a bubble, would close off. And the pyramid would come off the centrifuge and try to fly towards the direction of Orion. And actually got embedded in a wall, like it went through it, like through hyperspace.
Like
you see, yeah, I mean, you know, that's fascinating.
That is very fascinating.
And so a lot of the things that, you know, a colony collapse syndrome. Remember when the bees were dying and getting disoriented? We think we were able to show how that works through the pyramid energy and some of the experiments he did. So there's a lot that we don't know about. That Joe had discovered. He also feels it had like a magnetic hysteresis, that he was trying to manipulate it to go back to the time when it was built, and he felt he could do that, that the pyramid could act maybe as a time device, a time traveling device. So there's a lot of speculation there. We do have some facts, some experimental, you know, data that can't be explained.
Right.
And, you know, more work needs to be done. I'm hoping, again, some younger people with better equipment, more ingenuity than I have will follow up on it. And it's supposedly one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. To me, it's the first wonder by far. I'm probably the second wonder, right? You know?
Yeah, you always make me wonder.
So, but there's so much I could say about it. But that's the main thing. And so what its purpose is, you know, we don't know. And that's the speculation. And I think Joe has come the closest. And I think the Hertex, they have a really good idea in terms of the possible the energy production that could have been used, say, to do these things. Because let's face it, to use it as a device to move into another dimension or time, you're going to have a power energy source. And I think the Hertex idea could be the possible energy source that could have been used. Now, they may not agree with this, but I like to put things together, you know, to see how they could all work together. So anyway, we were going to do, unfortunately, the last show, we were talking about Dr. Patrick Flanagan, who we both worked with, and he wrote the foreword to my pyramid book, and he wrote, I think, the foreword to JJ's book. We all worked together on different things. And I was also, I worked with the Russians and Ukrainians for 8 years on pyramid research, and they released all their secret research to me for the past 15 years. This was many years ago, though, and I made it public, and it's actually in my book. It's on the website, so go to the website. I was their spokesperson. I guess I never could run for president now, huh?
I wouldn't say that.
The Ukrainians gave me the nickname 007. So, you know, anyway, did you have any other, I mean, I guess we're getting towards the end of the show. Did you have any questions, last minute questions?
It doesn't matter that I had any questions, but I do have a fun fact.
Yeah.
Since we only have a few moments left. Did you know that for 3,000 years until 1889, that the Pyramid of Giza was the largest man-made object on the planet?
What was made in 1889? The Eiffel Tower or something?
The Eiffel Tower. You got
it. Yeah, I think I have that. Actually, I had that in my first book here, which I'm assuming it's out of print. I have a big chapter going year from year of all the historical things that happened. And none of this was reproduced in the Barnes & Noble's book, Pyramid Dimensions, everything. I mean, this is really a source book and, you know, maybe something I should consider trying to.
But the mind-blowing thing is that for 3,000 years, it was the largest thing on the planet that was man-made.
So doesn't that make sense to you? How would a primitive culture like the Egyptians produce something like this? That
I know. Yeah. That's the enigma right there. Do we even know that it was man-made?
Well, that's a good question.
It's speculative.
Well,
we're not entirely sure.
No, here's some of the Orion stuff. I mean, there's so much stuff that is really, again, this is some of Joe Parr's research with the centrifuge and graphs. We have incredible amount of information I wanted to show you one here. We got we're running out of time, but you know, there's a lot of stuff we could have talked about and some of the facts, how big it is and the different chambers. But I think people basically want to know what the hell is its purpose. Like you said, since up until the Eiffel Tower, it was the largest structure on the globe, you know?
Man-made, yeah.
And then Napoleon, remember when Napoleon?
Yep.
You know, in Egypt? Yeah, and even like today, I kind of say I don't think we could recreate a Great Pyramid if we wanted to. You know, there's been special sewing, now they can make a little pyramid. But, you know, we're talking about something, you know, gigantic, you know, and it's just not going to be made, you know, with moving blocks and even cranes. You're not going to be – and the precision. So it's a good place to stop. And what we'll do if it's okay with you, be my co-host. Let's continue this next week, and let me talk about some of the Russian research, how their artificial pyramids, which were built, some of them are extremely built high. They cost millions of dollars. The National Academy of Russian Science produced them, and tie that in with some of our research. One thing, let me leave one interesting point that people are going to be blown away with. Joe Parr and the Russians independently said that certain parts of the pyramid may be harmful, may not be producing beneficial energies. And
yes.
Joe Parr even showed at certain times of the year, even in the most beneficial place, the energies are negative. So
yes.
It depends on when you're in the pyramid and in what part of it, and those change psychically. So, you know, the idea of building a pyramid house or living under a pyramid, there could be, this is speculation, but these are the measurements. I have a picture of a pyramid from the Russians with all the different energy levels in it, you know? Mm-hmm. So something to think about before you, I don't know if anybody getting hurt by doing that, but not everyone agrees. The Russians don't always agree with me with that because they said... They thought, because they built the pyramids, right? You know, the big ones. They said every part is beneficial. Where
the Russians are the harshest.
Yeah, the Ukrainians told me there were people that were working up on the top and passed out and had to be taken down. And so, you know, who do you believe and what's the true story? But Joe Parr would side with that. You know, it's not always beneficial and it depends. His thing was more on the season, you know, when you were in it. And what kind of energies was neutrino, gamma rays? What's the story? So there's a lot of things out there. I like the term wise tales that everyone just accepts. But mm-hmm. You and I have said this hundreds of times. Speculation is fine, but it's just conjecture.
Yeah.
You have to have the facts, and it's we don't have all the facts. Conjecture in the wind. Yet. Exactly. So, well, thank you, and thanks. Hope everyone doesn't mind my half an hour humor at the beginning. I had fun doing it. I needed that. I really needed that, you know. So thank you, Seraphine. You've been wonderful as usual. Maybe you can do the closing credits and give me a rest from my lame jokes.
Well, thank you again for having me as your co-host, John. And thank you again, everybody. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe. You can find John DeSalvo on all his social media accounts as John DeSalvo, or 007 in his picture, and his hats and his sunglasses. He's not hard to find. Or myself, Seraphine Hurley. This has been Paranormal X Hour. You will find us again on Mondays at 5 p.m. Central Time, and we will be back again with hopefully part two of the pyramids. And we do thank you for your listenership, and we do thank Joe Maltado, our producer, yes, and the
wonderful
the owner man of the station as well, here at 107.7 FM New Orleans, UPR on talkradio.com. You guys have a great evening, and thank you for listening to Paranormal X Hour with John DeSalvo and Seraphine Hurley.
Until next time, God bless you all. Thank you for listening.
The McDouble is here to add some sizzle to your day. And now you can enjoy it with McDonald's 4-for-4 deal. Choose between a cheesy McDouble or a delightfully crispy McChicken. Then add 4-piece chicken McNuggets, a small order of crispy fries, and a refreshing medium-sized soft drink like an ice cold Coke for just $4. Now that's a tasty deal. Swing by and add some sizzle to your day with McDonald's 4-for-4. Price and participation may vary, cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. The McDouble is here to add some sizzle to your day. And now you can enjoy it with McDonald's 4-for-4 deal. Choose between a cheesy McDouble or a delightfully crispy McChicken. Then add 4-piece chicken McNuggets, a small order of crispy fries, and a refreshing medium-sized soft drink like an ice cold Coke for just $4. Now that's a tasty deal. Swing by and add some sizzle to your day with McDonald's 4-for-4. Price and participation may vary, cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal.